It seems almost a contradiction in terms to try to measure creativity. But Dr. Charles Lim, a jazz sax player and hearing specialist at Johns Hopkins University, and Alan Brown of the National Institutes of Health were inspired to try. Dr. Lim and Dr. Brown set out to study what happens in a musician's brain while performing. Not memorized melodies, mind you, but specifically during improvisational riffs. Bill Evans did it. Miles Davis did it. So did John Coltrane. But how did they do that? Exactly what could have been going on in their brains when those musicians closed their eyes and spilled those notes out into the air, inventing as they went along? Dr. Charles Lim joins us from member station WYPR in Baltimore to talk about his study's findings. Dr. Lim, thanks so much for agreeing to talk with us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
This must have been some technical challenge, huh? How do you actually go about measuring what happens in the brain while it creates?
You know, scientists are always obsessed with breaking things down into controllable variables. And I think something like jazz is probably almost as far as you can get musically from something controllable.
Mm-hmm.
So really, it was just an idea we had to try to set out and study it scientifically using a functional MRI scanner.
A functional MRI scanner. That sounds like something that any one of us who wasn't well or had something going on could be exposed to, right?
Sort of. MRI is a way that we can basically image the brain, and it's usually used for anatomic purposes.
Uh-huh.
Now, a functional MRI is actually a way to modify the scan so that rather than looking at the anatomy of the brain, you're looking at the function, the blood flow of the brain, trying to find areas that are highly active or underactive within the brain and, you know, in response to a given task.
So when you conduct the study, how do you do it? Somebody's got something sitting on their head while they're playing their trumpet and you're watching some screen somewhere, the waves on it?
It's actually a little worse than that for the subject. They're actually lying on their back. Their heads are in a kind of a cage. They're looking up at a mirror, which is pointing to another mirror, which is pointing to their thighs. And then on their thighs, they had a plastic piano keyboard, which is safe for MRI purposes. And they were looking through this mirror at their fingers on this piano keyboard and then able to hear. They also had headphones on to boot.
Boy, I'll tell you, that sure would spark my creativity no end. Good heavens. So what did you find out? What is going on in the heads of musicians when they improvise?
What we did was took six professional jazz piano players and had them play either something very memorized or something that they totally made up on the spot. We, in fact, wrote a novel melody, a blues for them, and had them improvise on the blues.
Ah.
Now, when we looked at their brain activity, we found a really characteristic pattern. And when they were improvising, their brain went into this state. We call it a dissociated frontal activity state.
Oh, phooey. Just call it wonderful and magic. But what you're saying is really it shifts, the brain does, into a different gear, sort of, huh?
We think so. You know, there's this notion that a musician like Coltrane, when he's playing Giant Steps there, he's in the zone. I mean, he is far away from, you know, the concerns of everyday life, and he is in some other place where all of these novel ideas are flowing and pouring out of him. You know, how does he do that? Well, I think the brain really alters itself into this kind of creative mind frame where its purpose at that moment is to generate novelty and to decrease inhibition.
I wonder what you think about something like this. Click. This is the great Ella Fitzgerald, the queen of scat. And scat singing, that's improvised. So does the brain go through the same processes during scatting?
You know, our study was only of piano players, but I think the process we were studying was really independent of the actual instrument of choice. You know, conversation, people improvise conversation all the time. You and I right now are improvising this conversation to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the most creative modes, such as scat singing, which is, you know, it's really, she's using her voice like any other instrument, she's very likely using the same exact types of neural mechanisms.
Do you still play your saxophone, Dr. Lim?
I do all the time.
And has your playing changed now that you've learned more about all of this and what's happening? Has it made you more self-conscious, a better improviser, a less creative improviser? Any effect?
You know, it's funny. A lot of people have asked me if studying something like jazz takes away the magic of it for me. And to me, it doesn't at all. In a lot of ways, it augments it because I'm just stunned by all the things that the brain can do. It's a remarkable structure that allows us to generate beauty and spontaneity. And as far as my own playing goes, no, I'm more and more fascinated by music every day. And in fact, it's bordering on an obsession, to be quite frank.
Uh-oh. Thank you very much. Dr. Charles Lim is a hearing specialist at Johns Hopkins University. The study he did with Alan Brown was sponsored by the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders at the National Institutes of Health. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Here in Washington, the famed cherry trees are set to reach their peak at the end of this month. 30 years ago, you had to wait until the 5th of April for cherry blossoms. While spring began yesterday, March 20th, scientists say we are seeing the signs of spring earlier and earlier, an average of 8 hours earlier every year. Kirsten DeBeers is one of the scientists studying this phenomenon. She's an assistant professor of geography at Virginia Tech. She described for us two satellite images, one from 1982 and one from 2006, that showed us how things are changing.
What you start to see is that the greener areas are the areas where start of season is earliest in the map, if you just look at 1982. And then the light green, it's a little bit later. And then yellow, it's even later. And then red, it's very late.
So we're very clearly looking at a great deal more dark green on the 2006 map than the 1982 map.
Yes. If you compare 1982 with 2006, you will see that there's more dark green in 2006. And the green is extending further north, and then there's less red all the way in the north.
When I thought about this, I thought it would be spring moving from south to north, but this pretty much means spring happening all over the country 8 hours earlier, wherever it may be.
More or less, yes.
Are you gathering this information only by satellites, and what can the satellite actually see?
What the satellite sees is reflectance values. For example, this satellite sees red and near-infrared reflectance, and that's just a measure of how much vegetation is on the ground, basically. And
I understood very little of what you said, but I get the idea that if something's growing, the satellite can see it.
Yes. We have images every day, and so it changes every day, and we can see that over time.
And are you getting information, data from any other sources, from people who live in these places and can tell
Definitely.
You what's blooming?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. So this, of course, looking at the satellites is just one side of the story. I mean, it's the ground validation that really makes it. What we see from the satellite can be a little bit different from what we actually see on the ground. Right now, big area studies doing the ground validation, working with people on the ground. There's a project Budburst where you can go on the website and actually fill in your own information from your own yard if you want to. There's a lot of different citizen scientists that help us gather information. And, of course, the main thing right now is to validate our satellite data and see if what we think we see is actually happening on the ground.
What does it mean that spring is coming 8 hours earlier every year?
Well, what happens is that we see the vegetation start to occur earlier. And you can imagine that if maybe the timing of the vegetation changes, the animals have to adjust their timing as well. And that's not always very easy for them to do. And so what could happen is that you get a mismatch between vegetation timing and, for example, the timing that the birds migrate or that animals breed.
But wouldn't they be adjusting?
They would, but it's not necessarily said that they can adjust at the same speed as that the vegetation is changing right now. And so, I mean, if you, for example, think about birds and bird breeding, right? I mean, the time that the bird is laying its egg and the time that it's breeding there is a different timing of the years when the vegetation occurs. And so when it gets warmer, for example, and the vegetation starts, the timing of the vegetation changes, it's not necessarily said that those two processes behave at the same time and at the same speed and change at the same speed.
Well, should we be alarmed that spring is occurring 8 hours earlier every year? Is this part of climate change, do you think?
It looks like that. I'm not sure if we should be alarmed by it, but it's certainly something that we have to kind of keep our eye on and try to understand what is happening and why it's happening.
That's Kirsten DeBeers. She teaches geography at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg.
The NCAA men's basketball tournament is underway, and we are going to hear now about some March Madness. Thousands of Americans have filled in their office pool brackets, picking winners in dozens of games from this week's four presumably most predictable matchups between favored regional number one seeds and underdog regional number 16 seeds, all the way to the presumably unpredictable Final Four. Well, Neil Goodson, a senior math major at the College of Charleston in South Carolina, is part of a two-person team that's been working on a system to predict the tournament winners, and he joins us now from Charleston. Hiya. Welcome.
Hi.
And you'll note that, like some business announcements that are made after the markets close, we are letting your wisdom out to the public here after people have had to file all of their brackets in their office pools. So you're not going to influence betting all over the country right now.
Yes.
First of all, I want you to explain the assignment at the College of Charleston that has led you and your colleague to come up with a system for predicting the NCAA men's basketball tournament.
Okay, well, we are in an operations research class, and in that class, we look at applying math to real-world problems, and we chose to look at the problem of sports ranking or ranking teams.
And in this case, the NCAA ranks 64 teams, or used to be 65 teams for some reason, and they assign them different positions depending on which are the best and which are the weakest teams entering the tournament. So where do you pick up? Where do you apply your math there to predict it?
Okay, well, we have several different algorithms or models that we look at to come up with our own ranking of the teams, building matrices using linear algebra that have, 342 rows by 342 columns. Each column and each row represents a team, and we're entering data into those, just win-loss data, different point differentials between two teams, and we look at all this throughout the year. And then we also weight each game that we've looked at more heavily as it occurred towards the end of the year.
Aha, because a game that was played in early March would be more relevant than something they might have done in November or December.
That's what we think, and we hope that will prove our models correct.
And you assume there will be upsets.
Right, there will be upsets. They always happen. And some of our models do predict some upsets. For example, USC and Kansas State play tonight. Most of our models have predicted Kansas State, the weaker team, to beat USC, or supposed weaker team. Now, we think that they are a better team.
Well, it's possible that you'll be heard by some USC fans in Los Angeles when that game is well underway, so you could be a genius later on this evening if you're heard at that time. And you'll be the bearer of some very unhappy news, however, for the University of Southern California. Well, here's your moment of truth right now. Who's going to win the NCAA men's basketball tournament this year?
Most of our models are pointing towards Kansas. Now, they are one seed, but they are not the overall one seed. So we'll see how well we do.
Well, Neil Goodson, has your professor graded you yet, by the way, or is he waiting to see the results of the tournament and figuring out what your grade will be then?
Oh, no, the jury's still out on the grade.
See, we have to see results from the games.
That's right.
Well, good luck to you. Neil Goodson, a senior math major, and along with Colin Stevenson, the developer of a plan this year to predict the outcome of the NCAA men's college basketball tournament. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in your health, a new way to calculate your long-term risk of a hip fracture or other major breaks. It's an online tool created by the World Health Organization, and it combines lifestyle risks such as smoking and alcohol use with bone density readings and family history. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, the new method is helping people make more informed decisions about whether to take osteoporosis drugs.
If you're 65 and healthy, like Rosemary Munster, the results of a bone density scan, which may reveal the beginnings of osteoporosis, can really shake things up.
I had doctors telling me that this was such a terrible disease and I was so bad. So I had this picture of my bones like cottage cheese, just kind of falling apart, and that I'd be in a wheelchair.
All this anxiety was born of one number, a T-score reading, which is a measure of your bone density compared to what's found in a normal young adult of the same sex. For Munster, the number was low enough to justify treatment with osteoporosis drugs, and her doctors put her on two of them. When one of the medicines led to complications, she stopped taking it and went to see a specialist named Nelson Watts at the University of Cincinnati. He's using the new risk fracture tool.
So what we'll do is we'll go through these risk factors and you can tell me if they apply to you.
Okay. Watts and Munster sit at the computer in his office as he reads off a series of questions.
So have you had a previous fracture as an adult?
None.
Is there a family history of osteoporosis?
Definitely, yes.
Okay, well, this is more specific than that. So we've talked, and I know your mother got shorter and had spinal deformity that's called a Dowager's hump, but this specifically asks, did one of your parents have a hip fracture?
No hip fracture.
The questions continue. Are you a current smoker? Have you used prescription steroid medications? Do you have rheumatoid arthritis or untreated thyroid disease? All of these influence the risk of fractures. After all the questions are answered, Watts clicks the calculate button at the bottom of the screen.
When we push that button, it gives us the 10-year probability of fracture.
And the two numbers that appear are surprisingly good news. Munster's risk of hip fracture over the next decade is less than 1%. For other major breaks, her risk is 12%.
We're getting a thumbs up.
I'm really happy with that. That is really good news, because when I came here, I was scared to death.
The National Osteoporosis Foundation guidelines call for treating patients with drugs if their 10-year risk of hip fracture is 3% or higher, or if their risk of other major fractures is 20%. Watts says Munster's numbers clearly fall under these thresholds.
And so we concluded not only was it safe for her to stay off the medication that she'd stopped, but she didn't necessarily have to stay on the other medication either.
Munster decided to stay on the one drug called Avista. She sees it as a sort of insurance policy. And with a more accurate picture of her long-term risks, Munster says she no longer pictures her bones turning to cottage cheese. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
You can find a link to the WHO online calculator, plus tips for preventing osteoporosis at our website, npr.org/yourhealth. In this country, a debate over medical ethics just got more confusing. The basic issue is a stark one. Some doctors who are pro-life say they don't want to perform abortions. They don't even want to refer patients to doctors who will perform abortions. That last part about the referrals was the subject of an NPR report yesterday. But doctors' groups say if you refuse to refer a patient to another doctor, you're violating medical ethics. And that drew a protest from the Bush administration. Now the doctors' groups have clarified their position. They still think it's an ethics violation, but they're not going to take away doctors' certifications. Here's NPR's Julie Rovner.
Last Friday, HHS Secretary Mike Leavitt sent a letter to the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology with a copy to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or ACOG. Leavitt said he was concerned about a November ethics statement from ACOG stating that doctors should either be prepared to perform, quote, standard reproductive services, or else refer those patients to someone who will, and that the OBGYN board had made adherence to that policy a requirement for certification. Pro-life OBGYNs complained that would require them to make abortion referrals, something they morally opposed. And in his letter, Leavitt said that could violate federal laws protecting health workers' conscience rights. But Norman Gant, the OBGYN board's executive director, says HHS got it all wrong.
They took two and two and came up with five.
Gant says he would have responded sooner, but he was out of the office on a family matter. He did, however, back up what ACOG said Tuesday, which is that the Ethics Committee opinion regarding referrals is not a binding portion of the college's ethics code and therefore not a factor in the decision about board certification.
We do not restrict access to our exams for anyone applying for initial certification or maintenance of certification based upon whether they do or do not perform an abortion. We do not base this upon whether they do or do not refer a patient to an abortion provider if they do not choose to do abortions.
Gant said he dictated a letter back to Secretary Leavitt to that effect yesterday. He added that the board has long respected the fact that its members disagree on the abortion issue. More than a decade ago, it removed abortion from the list of cases to be used in oral exams. On the other hand, he said he personally had no problem with the November ethics statement, particularly the idea that OBGYNs should be ethically bound to provide contraception. But apparently the Bush administration doesn't agree. In an interview Tuesday, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health Don Wright said HHS would be relieved to find that the board isn't using the ethics statement for certification decisions. But as for ACOG,
we would still hope that they would revisit their position.
A spokesman for HHS said the department would have no further comment until it receives the board's written response. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
And next, we'll look at an issue that affects practically every doctor and patient. It's the practice of prescribing medicine based on tests for cholesterol, blood sugar, or thousands of other things that doctors can order. Sounds like a good idea, but recent studies show how misleading that can be. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
Doctors call it treating the numbers, trying to get a patient's test results to a certain target. They assume that will treat or prevent disease. But earlier this year, a study on a widely used cholesterol drug challenged that assumption. The drug is called Vytorin. It's a combination of two cholesterol-lowering agents. It certainly lowers cholesterol, but patients taking it didn't have any less plaque in a major artery than those taking a less potent drug. When the results came out, Dr. Steve Atlas of Massachusetts General Hospital began getting calls from his patients and his mom.
For my first patient, it was like, let's make a visit and schedule an appointment. For my mother, it became a longer discussion.
She's not so easy to put off. Right?
But she's not, exactly.
Ellen Atlas is a tennis-playing 75-year-old who's been taking Zetia, one of the cholesterol-lowering ingredients in Vytorin, because regular statin drugs caused muscle pain, a common side effect. Zetia reduced her cholesterol very nicely, but now she wanted to know if it was doing her any good.
For my mom, it was like, wow, I'm treating the number and I'm not going to necessarily prevent the stroke that her mother had. And all of a sudden, it was like, I don't want to take this medicine.
Steve Atlas was brought up short by the surprising cholesterol results.
It's a big deal because it reminds us of something that we often forget. The number isn't the outcome. And this raises concerns that just lowering the number doesn't get you where you want to be.
Dr. Ned Collange chairs a national task force that assesses what works and what doesn't in preventive medicine. He still believes that cholesterol-lowering drugs reduce heart disease, but he says the recent study challenges the goal of getting Americans' cholesterol lower and lower.
Now what's open is lower better? And I think a lot of people believed it would be, and there are many of us that were saying, you're going to need to show me.
And lately, studies have challenged other cherished assumptions, like lowering blood sugar. For a long time, doctors have believed that getting diabetic patients' blood sugar as close to normal as possible would prevent heart attacks. A drug called Avandia lowers blood sugar very well.
Avandia was approved in 1999 and heralded as one of the newer and greater drugs for the treatment of diabetes.
That's Dr. Cliff Rosen. He chairs the Food and Drug Administration Advisory Panel, which unanimously concluded last year that patients taking Avandia actually had more heart attacks and strokes. Rosen says the Avandia story is a caution against treating millions of patients on unproven assumptions. Normalizing blood sugar probably does prevent heart disease for patients with type 1 diabetes, but it's unproven for the far more common type 2.
It's not clear yet. Even now, even after all these years, that in type 2 diabetes, keeping your blood sugar at a certain point will prevent heart disease.
In fact, last month, a federal study showed that a big group of type 2 diabetics who got aggressive treatment to lower blood sugar actually had more deaths than those on standard therapy. The treating the numbers problem also comes up in decisions to use common tests. One is bone density scans for osteoporosis. Rosen, a bone disease specialist, often tries to talk patients out of getting the $400 scans to check on whether their drugs are working.
These are good drugs. They work in osteoporosis, but they work not just because they change bone density. That's the bottom line. And you know what? I've been 0% successful. I have never yet talked an individual out of a bone density follow-up measurement.
On the other hand, Steve Atlas, the Boston internist, says many of his patients are choosing not to take cholesterol-lowering drugs as a result of the recent study. But he's uncomfortable letting his own mother's elevated cholesterol go untreated.
Hello?
Hi, Mom. It's Steve.
Hi.
How are you doing this morning?
Ellen Atlas has stopped taking Zetia. She's improved her diet and increased her exercise. But her son is skeptical that'll be enough.
I obviously hope that your numbers are better with just the lifestyle changes that you've been making, because I think that would be great. But if they're still a little bit high, then starting sort of like a baby dose, a really low dose of
the... Which one do you think that I should go back to, one of the statins?
Mother and son hope a low dose of a tried-and-true statin will get her close to the right cholesterol number, without the side effects she suffered before. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.